That's great. Yeah, big deal.
That did get sent down to the committee.
Okay. Ready to go? Welcome, everybody, to the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. It's February 8th, 2016. For the record here, we're going to, I see we have Representative Johnson here, so we will start out by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 1510. Patrick and Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1510 specifies that a newly constructed bridge across the Columbia River as part of an extension of Oregon Route 35 near Hood River is designated as part of Oregon Route 35 to the center of the river channel. It also specifies that a transit district may use certain sources of funds for a secondary transit support system. This is a bill that we introduced as a committee bill, so we had an informational meeting on it in January. And we currently have a dash one amendment, which adds a third piece of the bill, which Mr. Russell will talk about. His amendment increases a couple weight limits for vehicles. The measure has a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Mr. Chair.
All righty. Representative, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, for the record, Mark Johnson from House District 52. I'm here today representing my community in Hood River, where we have a bridge that crosses the Columbia River there, known as the Hood River Bridge. It's owned by the Port of Hood River, and it's also within the National Scenic Area, which can create another layer of, let's just say, oversight. This past summer, Representative or Congressman Walden was able to get some language into the federal highway bill that makes it potentially possible for transportation projects within scenic areas to access federal funding for them. That's important because the bridge at Hood River is an antiquated structure built in the 1920s, designed for probably Model Ts, if you will. And nowadays we have hundreds of thousands of folks traversing across that bridge on an annual basis, probably maybe more than that. Log trucks, fruit trucks, we've got all kinds of commercial traffic that wasn't at all in play when this bridge was designed. So at some point, it's going to be necessary to replace that bridge because it's an absolutely vital link to our transportation system within the Columbia River Gorge. As you can imagine, if we didn't have that direct link between Hood River and White Salmon and all the businesses that just end commercial tourism, it would be catastrophic. So it's our hope that the language that's within this bill will allow us to be eligible at some point in time. There's no guarantee, obviously, but it would allow us to be eligible to tap into some federal funding resources to, at some point, assist with the eventual planning and preparation for replacement of that bridge. So with that, I will turn it over to Michael McElway, who is actually the port director for the Hood River, and he will give you the specifics. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Byers, thank you. Members of the committee, my name is Michael McElway. I've served as the executive director of the Port of Hood River for about 10 years now. I think the representative has probably become an expert now on the bridge, and I can't add a whole lot. Much of the bridge was built in 1924. Substantial elements were reconstructed and enlarged in 1938 after Bonneville Dam went in. It's approximately 0.8 miles long, and we're currently reaching about four million trips annually, which is, of course, both commuters and truck traffic. The bridge is inadequate. Its efficiency rating is below 50, 45.6 to be exact. It's functionally obsolete, and it needs to be replaced. The challenge is replacing it and what trajectory we get on and what steps we need to take to ultimately replace that bridge. Cost estimates range from $260 to $280 million eventually. The FAST Act provides an opening, a foothold, on the long path to replacement of the bridge. And although it doesn't specifically make national scenic areas a criterion to become funded, it does allow an opening. It's a criterion that allows us to identify this bridge as something different, something special among the 12 national scenic areas in the country, in a way in which that we can seek funding through the application process. So 1510 is a bill that would designate the south half of the bridge as being on the Oregon highway system, OR 35. Interesting enough, the north half of the bridge has already been designated as Highway 35 in Washington. This was done by the Washington legislature in 1997. So we have a situation where this key element in our local economy, 4 million trips a year, and very vital to the logging and also the fruit industry in Hood River and white salmon, has a half of a designation as a state highway and half not. What's critical, and critical in terms of timing, is that we are able to demonstrate that there's a commitment by the state and with legislative intent, recognizing that it still administratively has to go through the Oregon Transportation Commission, that the entire bridge is on the National Highway System, because that's another criterion for funding under the FAST Act program. It has to be a facility that's on the National Highway System. So thus, the need for the legislature to show their intent and demonstrate not only to the state but also to the federal government that this is an important element and needs to be added. You'll see in a packet that either has been or will be handed out to you some significant letters of support. The Maritime Pilots Association has submitted a letter of support. Congressman Walden has submitted a letter of support. The One Gorge Advocacy Group, which represents over 100 different agencies, both public and private, has submitted a letter of support. And importantly, I would point to the letter in this packet that has signatories from not only senators and representatives on national level from Oregon, but also from Washington. So in a fairly remarkable degree of bipartisan, bicameral, and importantly, bi-state support, both constituencies on both sides of the river have indicated that this is an important step to take. So I'd ask you to look at that. There's a graphic in the packet that also indicates what part of the bridge is on the National Highway System, what part of the bridge is not on the highway system, and consider the letters of support. I would also point out that ODOT has been, in the last few weeks, been remarkably supportive of this effort. There are administrative means and methods to obtain the same designation. And there's one that's most recently suggested by ODOT a few weeks ago that would allow us to go through a fairly quick process, we believe, or they say, to get this done. We still believe this bill is important to show, again, legislative intent. And because the Secretary of Transportation has just indicated that the NOFA, the Notice of Funds Availability, will be forthcoming in the next few weeks. So this is a rapid turnaround. And in order to get our foot in the door in the initial phases of the FAST Act application process, we would very much like to demonstrate that we have met the criterion, which is it's on the federal highway system. So with that, I would ask the support of this committee and of this legislature for this Senate Bill 1510.
Thank you.
Thank
questions,
you.
Senator Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understood that you just say that Washington has already designated the north half as State Route 35.
Yes, sir.
Washington State Route, I assume.
Yes, sir.
And we have not. But then I heard you say later that half of the bridge is part of the National Highway System. Is that correct?
The north half, that's right. So being on the Washington State Highway System, which is a legislative designation, and that's on the National Highway System as well.
So the National Highway has designated half of a bridge as...
Well, that's because there's a state line that roughly bifurcates the bridge. So
already put the other half on the National Highway System because that's two separate things. The state designation and the national designation are two different things.
At least in Washington State, the National Highway designation followed the state.
It did.
Designation, yeah.
Okay.
Other questions?
Good question.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank
Let's
you.
Go back to work, Representative.
Appreciate it.
I guess you are.
Okay.
Let's see. Paul Mather.
I'm not sure his answer was correct.
Welcome, Paul.
Thank you, Chair Byard, member of the committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator. Just want to spend a little bit of time kind of clearing up the process piece of this just from a government bureaucracy, maybe standpoint, to make sure we got designations clearly of what we're talking about. So the bill, what it does is puts Route 35 onto a newly constructed bridge across Hood River, and the need for improved transportation in the gorge is clear. We've seen that with the deficiencies both in, as was talked about, in the Hood River Bridge, but also in the Bridge of the Gods and other needs in the gorge. So that's not really what I'm here to talk about. It's more just make sure we got the right process piece to get the end result that we want, to make sure we're competitive for these new FAST Act grants that are going to be coming out, and make sure we got the right pieces in place to do that. So two key things you've already talked about: the route designation and then the national highway designation. The national highway designation is a federal designation. States can't designate highways themselves independently for the national highway system. So Washington doesn't have that authority. Oregon doesn't have the authority. What each state has the authority to do is put route numbers out there, which really doesn't have any bearing on the application. The application is you've got to have the national highway designation is the key piece. In Washington, the authority to set those designations for the route numbers is the legislature. In Oregon, the authority to do that is the Transportation Commission. And in all cases around the state, all our route designations are designated by the Transportation Commission. This bill would set a precedent by having this one be the only one set by the legislature. The reason we have route numbers to begin with is really not a public policy or a priority from a government policy issue. It's really to help drivers understand the routes that they're on and where they're going. So we use those routes to, you know, publish things like the state highway map for people to get around and navigate. They're not something that makes a difference from a federal standpoint in applying for federal grants. What they look for is the National Highway System designation, again, which is a federal designation. And we have many routes in the state of Oregon that aren't on the state highway maps route designation, many of them that go to the Portland Airport, that go to the Medford Airport, that go to key transportation hubs, are part of the national highway system but don't have recognition on the map or aren't state highways. So again, we're not talking about in this bill designating this as a state highway, state owned this bridge. The ownership is still going to retain with the port. And the only thing we'd be doing is putting a route shield on there saying it's Route 35. What we need to stay focused on is this National Highway System designation. And as the previous panel talked about, we've already engaged that conversation, working with the state of Washington to begin that process, to do our staff work from a state standpoint and local ownership of the bridge standpoint. Ultimately, that's going to be a Federal Highway Administration approval, thumbs up or thumbs down, on whether it's on the National Highway System. And that's the designation that's needed to apply for these FAST Act grants. So hopefully that's helpful.
So the designation doesn't do anything?
Not in terms, Mr. Chair, not in terms of applying for federal grants.
Okay. Senator Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Same question. Do you agree that the northern half is already on the federal highway designation?
Chair Beyer, Senator Riley, no. From our understanding on the Washington side, it's not part of the national highway system because that's, again, a federal designation, not a state designation. And for that to happen, the Federal Highway Administration would have to make that designation.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much, Paul. Okay, now Bob Russell.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations. I realize that your agenda is pretty packed this afternoon, so I'm going to try to be really brief. My interest is in the Dash 1 amendments, and the part of those that are significant is on page 3. And again, in the FAST Act, which is the Federal Highway Reauthorization Bill, there was some provisions in there that allowed for increases in truck weights. One of them allowed, which is sub 10 on page 3, if you have an APU, an auxiliary power unit, we had a provision that allowed you to increase your weight by 400 pounds. The FAST Act, they changed that to 550. So you'll see the change there. The second thing that they did is they said if you've got a natural gas-fueled truck, that you could increase the weights by 2,000 pounds, and that accommodates the extra weight of the tanks and those kinds of things to use that type of fuel. So I've talked with ODOT. They are fine. They should give us the thumbs up back there. And it's not controversial. It just puts us in line with federal law.
Okay. Questions of Bob? Senator?
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The problem I have is this bill has three component parts that really are totally unrelated. And I'm going to be stuck. Do I vote for two things that I like, but one that I dislike, and it's kind of a mess. And I wish that, and I know in a short session it's impossible to have your own little bill. And this was a relating clause everybody jumped onto, but this is going to be a very difficult vote.
Anybody else? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And let's see, last person I have signed up is Bernie Bottomley.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Bernie Bottomley with TriMet. I'm speaking on Section 4 of the bill. We covered this in the work session earlier, but just to recap, what the bill would do is to modestly expand TriMet's authority to expend funds on projects that are part of the transportation system but are part of the system that we don't directly run our vehicles on. Currently, the only funds that TriMet can expend on those types of facilities are funds that are constitutionally restricted, ownership, operation, or use of a motor vehicle, or storage, use, or transmission of a motor vehicle fuel. And since TriMet doesn't have a source of those funds, and we don't typically get those as grants, we're not able to participate in projects and strategies in the region that require building facilities that aren't ones that we directly run on. And as the region grows and as congestion in the region increases, we're increasingly finding that a lot of the solutions that the region designs for those congestion strategies are multimodal, they're regional, they aren't always site-specific. And so what we'd like to do is to modify the language to allow us to expend specific, narrowly defined set of funds on projects that are not ones that we specifically run on. This wouldn't include changing the current ability for us relative to our payroll tax and our major operating resources. Those would still be restricted to TriMet's facilities and TriMet operations. This would only be funds that we derive from grants and other outside resources that are essentially pass-through types of funds that we might receive. For example, TriMet has a very strong bond rating. We're the only transit district in the country of our type that has a AAA Moody's bond rating. And we also have a AAA Standard & Poor's rating. What we've been able to do is to provide a tool for the region in bonding streams of federal resources, bringing those resources to current year, defederalizing those dollars so that the projects that they're used on don't have to bear the burden of federal overhead, and advancing the projects in time so they don't suffer the consequences of cost inflation over time. And there are multiple projects around the region that can benefit from that tool. So we'd like to be able to extend that to other projects. So as I mentioned, doesn't apply to our operating resource. Those would still be fenced off and only available for TriMet operations. It would only be outside resources that come into the agency. So hope you can support that change and recommend moving forward.
Questions of Bernie? Senator Durack?
Yeah, I have a lot of angst. I didn't originally, but I do now, because, and correct me if I'm wrong, but your PERS, you have not, how much have you set aside for your PERS retirement system?
Chair Beyer and Senator Girard, TriMet is not a member of the PERS retirement system.
They have their separate
so
system.
It's a very
okay, how
separate.
Much of that is as have you set money aside for?
For our defined benefit programs, two things. One is that we've discontinued the defined benefit program for any new employees, and that's been in place for a number of years. So we've capitated the defined benefit cost. And we have been, the board has adopted a 15-year finance plan to fully fund the defined benefit programs for both the union and non-union employees. We're now at about 60% funded on the union side and about 70% funded on the non-union side. And we expect those to be fully funded within the next 15 years.
But correct me if I'm wrong. The dollars that go into TriMet, how much of TriMet is really sufficiently funded? How much does the system pay for itself, I guess, is a better way of putting it?
Well, those
you're expanding out your costs, and I don't think you can afford what you got now. And, you know, ridership's going up and that sort of thing. And everything, you know, you're constantly looking for more money. So why do you want to be able to do more things when you can't afford what you have now?
Well, Senator Beyer, Senator Girard, as I pointed out, these are not funds that would be available for operations. These are grant funds that would be only available for capital. So we can't use those funds for operations. They wouldn't be available for additions to funding defined benefit programs. They wouldn't be ongoing resources that could be available for operations.
These grants, why wouldn't they be available by the city or the county then? Why does it have to go through TriMet and it couldn't go through ODOT or some other agency?
They could. Many of those entities are not in a position to be able to bond those resources in the way that TriMet can. We have the ability, we've been very prudent and very careful with our bonding authority, as the AAA bond rating would indicate. And those other jurisdictions are not always in a position to be able to do that bonding in the way that we can. And generally speaking, they're not regional authorities either. So we have the ability to do this work on a regional basis for regional facilities in a way that the city of Portland, for example, wouldn't be able to do.
Who's on the hook if there's a default?
TriMet.
Who's on the hook if TriMet defaults?
It would be the TriMet budget. So it would be whatever resources we've pledged in order to get the bond rating. And
is Multnomah County on the hook
no.
for you? Who's on the hook for you?
No one. We're a state chartered corporation that's independent from the other governments.
Separate.
Nope, I'm good.
Anybody else?
I just want to make kind of the same comment Senator Girard made, that due to the short session and not having enough bills to cover these things, I mean, I'm all in favor of 1510. I'm all opposed to 1521. So I'd like to see these two issues voted on separately, if that's possible.
Wait. Yeah, they're two separate.
Okay.
I don't know what he wants me to do with the gavel, so a little at a loss here. It's really tempting. The adjournment for the day might be in that order.
It's all yours, Fred.
I think the words you're looking for are good bill should pass.
I'm going to have a hard time with that one. Okay, thank you for your testimony. I'm not going to close this because I have no idea what he's going to do. Do you want to go to 1521? Do you know what he wants to do?
Absolutely. We can go to 1521, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to I'm going to recess. Is that appropriate?
Sure.
Recess 1510. I'm going to open 1521.
We just did.
Yes. Patrick, you want to?
Absolutely.
Try not to come up here if it wasn't on the bill.
One moment, please. Okay, so, Mr. Chair, so Senate Bill 1521 authorizes mass transit districts to impose a tax on employees of employers within the district if the district imposes an excise tax on those employers. It restricts the use of employee tax revenues to enhance frequency of bus service acquisition of buses, bus service expansion or maintenance and operation of buses. It applies to tax reporting periods beginning on or after January 1st, 2017. It authorizes municipal transit agencies to levy taxes as authorized for mass transit districts, and it would take effect upon the 91st day of following adjournment sine die. We also have a dash one amendment, which removes the requirement that the district imposing the tax by ordinance do so on every employee of employers subject to the tax. It changes the requirement that the tax be rate be set at 0.185% of wages paid to employees employment to the rate of 0.185 being the maximum tax rate. For clarification, Mr. Chair, this bill is a separate concept than the one that was just being discussed, which is a part, which is capital, which would be bonding for capital projects through TriMet. This is a bill that was President Courtney's bill.
To help pay for TriMet?
Any transit agency in the state that currently has an employer tax, an employer payroll tax, this would allow the use of employee payroll tax.
So then,
yes.
That gets back to my question. There's two issues in 1510.
Yes.
Now, are we going to separate those out?
That's my question. We are not planning to move 1510 today. How about that?
Okay.
Okay. Okay. I'm going to hear the pros first. Let's have TriMet come forward. Is it good? Thank you. Is that trouble with your name? I'll just go TriMet.
I understand, Mr. G. Rod.
Well, it's better than Gurod than Guy Road.
thank you. My name's Aaron Dees, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Aaron Dees with TriMet. I would like to speak in support of 1521. First, I'd like to express our appreciation for Senator Courtney bringing this legislation forward and the committee taking it up. This is worth having the conversation about, whether or not anyway, we're grateful for the Senator Courtney and committee's interest. Transit districts serve many missions. We connect people with jobs. We help address congestion on clogged roadways. We provide critical safety net for people who rely on public transportation to meet their basic human needs. This legislation would provide a critical tool for transit and municipal transportation districts to meet the most basic transportation needs of their communities. For smaller transit programs across the state who have struggled to find funds just to scrape by, who have made do with old equipment that should have been retired years ago, this will be an opportunity to finally improve and expand upon perhaps move beyond starvation mode. For larger districts like TriMet, this tool could potentially be helpful to provide resources needed to address some of our critical challenges in our extraordinarily fast-growing metropolitan area. For example, we could use these tools to achieve the service levels called for in the Portland area's regional transportation plan to respond to congestion and to avoid the loss of 6,500 permanent jobs and $844 million annual congested-related costs by 2025. We expand connections between increasingly dispersed areas of affordable housing in the region and key middle-income employment clusters such as the Columbia Corridor, Troutdale-Reynolds Industrial Park, and regional industrial reserves in Washington and Clackamas counties. We could support levels of transit service needed to meet our region's climate smart solution strategy. We could explore with our partners opportunities to address concerns of our low-income riders and work on low-income fare and or expanded fare subsidy program. Built on the successes of partnerships with City of Portland and Portland Public Schools, we could continue to provide a youth pass program, particularly in areas with significant low-income student populations like Centennial, David Douglas, Park Rose, and Reynolds, and other districts around the region that have high proportions of students qualifying for free and reduced lunch programs. And recognize that all transit users are pedestrians and bike riders before and after they use our system. It would allow us to more fully partner with cities, counties, Portland and community, metro and community groups to fill in the gaps in the transit supportive infrastructure in our region, including sidewalks, bike facilities, ADA ramps, safe routes to schools, and other allowing riders to connect to our transit system. Of course, this legislation is not mandating that this happens. It adds another tool to our toolbox for being able to raise revenue. We already have a number a fairly broad array of them. This would just add us another one. It would allow us to but we obviously, before we do anything, we would go before our board would be in a position to even contemplate using the additional authority, a much fuller discussion with the business community, with our local government partners, community groups, and stakeholders in the region would need to be able to reach a consensus on the right level of resource and the appropriate deployment of the new and expanded services. So once again, we'd like to thank Senator Courtney and the committee for bringing this bill forward to give us a platform to continue to explore opportunities to address pressing transportation needs of Oregon's transit-reliant, low-income elderly youth and people with disabilities populations. Thank you.
Is there any questions? Senator Riley.
Thank you. So,
I just recessed.
The tax that we're talking about on employees, of employers who are now taxed, is that what employers are now taxed? What sorts of, not by name, but by type?
Chair Beyer, Representative Senator Riley, all employer, there are a small group of employers that are not taxed in our Metropolitan Service District. I think, if I remember correctly, it's insurance, and I think nonprofits, if I remember correctly. I can get you a list of the ones. There aren't very many. Self-employed folks are, and almost every other business.
Thank you.
And follow? I have a question. Okay, we just heard from TriMet that you're a triple bond rating and you're just doing wonderful. So can you tell me, there's a little disparity here between these two bills, one saying, hey, I need more tax revenue, the other one saying, hey, we're doing so well, give us bond authority. So please kind of differentiate why I don't understand the dichotomy of these two bills.
Certainly. Chair Beyer, Senator Girard. The two bills are transit has two, I wouldn't say competing, but sort of things that need to go forward at the same time. We need to invest in capital in our region, and we need to be able to provide operating, to provide bus service, and to provide MAX service. Senate Bill 1510 gives us a tool. It doesn't, we don't necessarily, it doesn't implement the tool. It gives us a tool to be able to look at our region and say, and say, we would like to be the facilitator for a regional transportation conversation in which we look at transit projects, we look at road projects, we look at safe routes to school projects and other things, and say, let's put together a large package. And we'll make these investments in highways. We'll make these investments in sidewalks. We'll make these investments in transit, and we'll capital investments. And TriMet would be able to do that. In current statute, TriMet has a broad a taxing authority. It has a narrow, specific way in which we can spend transit these funds, and that would be on areas in which we already run buses and trains and on our own properties. What 1510 does is says, if we are given money by basically reimbursed by the region or by the voters via a ballot measure, we can spend money on places that we don't necessarily run those services. And that would allow us to work on maybe putting forth some highway improvements as part of an overall larger package that we couldn't currently participate in that conversation right now, because if it isn't where we run a bus or it isn't where we run a MAX train, we can't direct the money there. So that's what 1510 does. 1521 is an extension of the conversation that we had last session around how to fund transit, and it was as part of the group of Magic 8 Ball or whatever you want to call them that gave the boards of entities that already have payroll tax the ability to implement this after they go through a process. So our capital needs and our operations needs are on kind of different schedules. We get capital funding via routes for the federal government. We get, you know, there's a lot of ways to piece it together. Our operating funds are limited by basically payroll tax and fares and then some grants. And most of our funding comes from an employer side payroll tax. What this bill is suggesting is that we put a very low level, broad ranging tax upon everyone so that we don't, so that we have another leg added to the funding stool. And again, it's not implementing it. It's giving us a tool to do something. That's so,
yeah, go ahead.
How broad-based is this? You know, like, I know that you go into Washington, Multnomah, and Clackamas counties, but there's a lot of rural Clackamas County. So is this a fee to Colton or?
It would only be with this, Senator Regard, this would only be in the TriMet Service District. So if we implemented it, it would exclude areas like Boring. It would exclude areas like Canby, Sandy, other places that we don't serve. If you're not in our service district, you wouldn't be affected by this.
Okay.
Yeah, another question. So I hear you say this is not an implementing, but it is allowing you to do it. You're the TriMet is the authority that would implement it. Is that correct?
Chair Byer, Senator Riley, this actually would be for all payroll tax entities. So it would include Lane Transit District. It would include Wilsonville, Sandy, Canby. I think it's South Clackamas. But our boards would have to take up the process of implementing this. It would give us another tool to solve our own problem.
So you say you take up the process of implementing. So a board, if we do this, a board can impose a tax on employees of those employers.
Chair Byer, Senator Riley, yes.
Thank you.
More?
Thank you very much, Aaron. Edward. Yeah, we're back up there.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Edward McLone representing Lane Transit District. We are one of those other transit districts that Aaron referred to that would be able to collect this tax if our board elected to, after a process of working with our community to decide when the appropriate time and how the appropriate way to spend the money would be. I just wanted to give a little more color commentary on where these resources and what the impacts of your decision to pass this bill may have. Lane Transit District is generally, you could consider us to be like a tenth of the size of TriMet. We cover most of the populated area of Lane County. We cover Eugene, Springfield, the cities of Cottage Grove, Junction City, Veneta, Cresswell, Coburg, as well as all the way up the McKenzie River to McKenzie Bridge, which is near the crest of the Cascade Mountains along Highway 126. Our service provides about 10 million rides a year, and we have a $40 million operating budget. We operate two lines of bus rapid transit known as MX, which is effectively light rail on wheels, and we are in a process working with our community to decide potential routes on another five corridors. For Lane Transit District, if our board adopted this tax increase, it would generate in the neighborhood of $7 to $8 million a year of new payroll tax revenues that would be directed towards one of the four categories of expenditure in the bill, where our largest focuses would likely be on new and enhanced transit service as well as new vehicles. You have to buy, as you add more service, you buy more buses, because we don't just keep extra buses sitting around. We're actually limited in how many extra buses we may have. For our community, what we've heard a lot about need is increased frequency along major two corridors. Our bus routes run about every 30 minutes along some of the most populated and congested streets in Eugene and Springfield. That is part of the development of that MX bus rapid transit network that would bring that service from every 30 minutes and 15 minutes at the peak to 10-minute and 15-minute service throughout weekdays and slightly less frequently on weekends. The two existing lines of bus rapid transit we have operating in Eugene, for example, have yielded over $250 million of private development along those corridors. And so there's excitement in our community about the potential to achieve that, yet uncertainty on how we would generate the funding to operate buses on a significantly higher frequency needed in order to be competitive for federal grants. Additionally, we also have interest in our community about restoring the youth transit pass, which was eliminated when the legislature changed the business energy tax credit program. We saw a substantial drop in youth ridership and corresponding impacts actually on student attendance in some of our local high schools and middle schools. The cost of providing that is substantial, and there's not an existing funding source to do so. So our board of directors and our local schools are interested in having that conversation. Those are sort of the highlights. I'll leave it at that, and then I'll be happy to answer any further questions from you.
Senator,
the question I have is the rural part that you said that was in the transit, McKenzie Bridge, you kind of threw out as a name. So would the people at McKenzie Bridge pay the same rate as somebody that lives in downtown Eugene?
Mr. Chair, Senator Girod, all folks who are taxed by the taxing district would be taxed at the same rate.
That's the Constitution.
I'm just saying.
As Chair Beyer pointed out, we do not have the choice. That is what we are mandated to do by law and Constitution.
Just smells.
Any questions?
Seeing none. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's see. Chair Ludlow.
Can you add this to Senator?
Welcome.
Thank you. I know so many of you and probably should know more. Chair Beyer and Senators, for the record, my name is John Ludlow. I'm Chair of the Clackamas County Board of Commissioners. I certainly appreciate you giving me the opportunity to speak here today. We at Clackamas County feel that the increased transit services should not be subsidized from the paychecks of employees who work within a transit district. It is unfair to tax all employees whether they use transit or not. Not counting TriMet, Clackamas County has three other transit districts. Those have been mentioned before: Wilsonville, Sandy, and Canby. I have no doubt that this tax would be advantageous to them. And I believe I hope you believe me when I say I hope that they all succeed. But I struggle to believe that people working inside the boundaries of these tax transit districts want to, let alone can, afford this tax. At $34,000, somebody would owe $64. We're crying to have $25 per driver to take care of our maintenance of the roads. I feel that we shouldn't be billing anything more unless we can take care of what we got. At that kind of money, at $64, and that's just for somebody making $34,000, if we had that same tax, we could take care of all of the deferred maintenance and finally put those two lanes on I-205. I'm frustrated that a transit agency would be granted funding authority from the state legislature to tax employees for their dollars unwillingly that they will give forward. And right now, how many employees in those districts know that this bill is before you, and this all of a sudden they could have quite a large tax affixed to their paycheck? These dollars will not improve our failing roads, will not improve gaps in local transportation funding. In fact, these taxes will buy more buses to drive on those very failing roads that we're trying to save. And larger tax districts like TriMet will be back at the table asking for more dollars when competitive transportation funding cycles come back around. It is quite ironic that they say we're just fine. Well, we need money for both capital and operations. That's not fine in my way of thinking. While I recognize this bill has a permissive allowance, the largest agency that would benefit from this bill is TriMet by far, drawing roughly $70 million per year. Remember in 2010 when they went out for a bill, it died. It died 2-1 in my county. Their board of directors are not even elected. Yet would be permitted to implement this. Is that not taxation without representation? Meanwhile, counties and cities across Oregon who are struggling to maintain adequate and safe road services must seek out voter
approval for significant tax changes like the one being proposed like in this bill. There's the key missing partner in this, the voter, the person that is going to have it taken from their paycheck. If SB 1521 passes, it will make it challenging, if not impossible, for cities and counties to pass any ballot measure seeking additional revenue for their roads. Telling all the employees in a transit district that they need to pay for mass transit is tantamount to telling the cattle industry and they must support the tofu industry. Clackamas County Board of Commissioners have voted unanimously to oppose this bill. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify for you today. I just want to clearly say again, please do not move forward with this bill. If ever I've seen a more ripe bill for referendum in the state, this one would get people going. Any questions today?
Any question?
Thank you very much, Commissioner.
All right, Drew Hagedorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Drew Hagedorn, appearing today on behalf of the Oregon Transit Association. We're the industry association for transit agencies large and small throughout the state. Want to give a little bit of foundational information. Some of it has been touched upon, but I'll give it from more of a holistic statewide perspective and from the association's perspective as well. The genesis of this idea, as you might recall, derived from the group of transportation negotiators in 2015, and I think you, Mr. Chair, were one of the folks that were involved in that conversation. So we did have some deliberations on this topic before the Senate Special Committee that reviewed that policy. This bill, as you've heard previously, is distinguished from the proposal related to transit during the 15th session insofar as it would require that extra step, the local transit body to approve or ratify the tax to be applied within its boundaries. This is a local funding mechanism that's envisioned here as an industry association, or as a transit association, I should say. We're also interested in working on transportation policies to identify a dedicated state source of funding. We have some limited amounts of state funding that transit districts in Oregon can utilize, but there isn't a significant source like there is in many other states which utilize a sales tax, a piece of that to finance transit infrastructure or even a gas tax in some states. So we're going to continue working with policy makers on that, and I think the eye there is towards the 2017 legislative session. As also was noted earlier, what we're talking about here are mass transit districts. Those are the agencies that are authorized to have an employer-based payroll tax. And as you heard, that's TriMet, that's Lane Transit District, Jan and Eugene, and some of the legacy agencies that were part of TriMet, such as Wilsonville, Canby, and Sandy. So that's the population or the scope of entities that would be authorized to apply this tax. So I just add that for background. I think what's important here is the recognition that one size fits all doesn't necessarily work in the transportation sector, and indeed that's true for transit. This is a proposal that might work for mass transit districts. There was a House proposal that was debated that was more focused on small to medium-sized transit districts that have entirely different missions, and the services that they provide, they're more focused on connecting communities, serving the elderly, disabled, and veteran population who need access to goods and services within their community. And so we're also working to identify opportunities to provide those services. So with that, I would thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing this, and thank the Senate President for introducing the concept. Even if it isn't a concept that works for everyone, I think it's important to have the discussion about investments in transit, and we'll look forward as an association to continue working with this assembly on the road ahead. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Does not.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Charles. Ms. Steve, would you like to come up at the same time? Mr. Steve.
Oh, sure.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Charles, president of Cascade Policy Institute, and a longtime transit rider. And I'm skeptical of this bill, suggest that you not pass it for a couple reasons. First, there are a couple premises of the bill One is that there's a need for outside money from these transit districts. They haven't actually made a numerical case for that. There's no finding in the bill that says it. It's just kind of a random tax increase. There's also an assumption that the promises made in this bill in Section 7, that if you give them this new revenue, it will be spent exclusively on new, improved service, will be honored. And you might ask, how will you know that's going to happen? I like to learn from the past, and we saw this movie before, back in 2003, a variation of it, I should say, when the existing employer-based tax rate for TriMet and Lane Transit was raised. They came in with a proposal to increase it over a 10-year period. They promised that all the revenue, at least TriMet promised that all the money would go, as Fred Hansen then said, quote, TriMet's proposed payroll tax increase will be used exclusively to provide new or enhanced transit service. And their board chair, George Pasador, chimed in, I would like to reiterate the board's commitment to using any money created by the rate increase to pay for new and improved service. I was there for all that. I warned the legislative committees, all four of them that heard it, that probably wasn't going to happen. The bill passed. And this blue chart that I gave the committee assistant, I set up the chart to keep track of it. Okay, what's going to happen over the next 10 years as these rate increases go in? And every year I'd add another column to the chart. Well, total operating resources went up 80% over a 10-year period. I mean, they hit the cash gusher. It was coming in. Hours of service declined by 5%. Miles of service to actual customers like me, down 14%. So there is no correlation between throwing money at the problem and actual service. There's negative correlation. So I think there's a couple of problems with what's going on here. One is the cost of employee compensation. There's no discipline in the system. For TriMet, the most egregious problem has been that in 2001, which we can refer to as the good old days, the cost of total cost of employee benefits equaled 61% of the cost of wages. Well, by 2009, it was 129%. 2011, it was 163%. It continued to stay high. As of 2014, benefits were 149% of wages. I actually know of no place where that occurs, even in the notoriously overpriced municipal monopolistic transit district. Even big districts back east don't have that kind of ratio. And the other problem is that there's no discipline on fare box recovery. That's not a term that came up by the advocates of the bill, namely, how much skin in the game is there by customers like me? And for me personally, I have never opposed a TriMet fare increase in over 30 years. In fact, I constantly tell them and all the other districts that I use, you're underpricing your product. You're giving the thing away. And so TriMet only gets about 27% of their operating revenue out of the fare box and none of the capital. Other districts are even less. And so when you just throw money at this, and you don't talk about these other factors, you're sort of enabling this dysfunctional behavior to continue, and the conversation becomes very random. More money, why? What's the benchmarks? How do we know? None of that comes into play. So I'll just leave you a suggestion for a deal you can make with the proponents, that this session is not the right session for this. Just put it aside and tell them to come back asking for this when the fare box recovery ratio exceeds 50%, so we know that the actual customers are willing to pay at least half the cost of operations before they want money from non-users, and B, when the ratio of benefits to wages is less than 50%, like most real businesses in the country where the ratio is far, far less than 50%. If those two criteria were met, to me, that would be evidence of a kind of financial house of order conversation taking place, and then you might find it appropriate to have this conversation about the bill. But until those two things take place, I think there's actually too much money flowing to those districts, and not enough discipline and not enough skin in the game by those who benefit the most, which is transit customers. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Senator?
One more time. What was the percent of every dollar that's paid for by fares? You gave a...
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gerard, the fare box recovery ratio?
Yes.
For TriMet, I believe about 27%, it could fluctuate by a few percent up or down, depending on what month you're talking, I guess. About 27% of the operating costs come from users and none of the capital costs. And for them, being in the rail, since they're primarily a rail construction entity, the capital costs are mammoth.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
I'm Steve Schopp. I live in Tualatin. Thank you for allowing me to speak, Chair and Committee. You know, if this was a CRC bill and you were asked to provide TriMet with a new revenue stream to go it alone to for bonded indebtedness to revive the CRC, I think that there'd be some objection to that, would there not?
Yeah.
Not for me.
Well, that's essentially what this is. And if you do the math on this, which I have, and you look at the numbers, and the first year alone, TriMet will be getting a revenue stream of $71 million. And I went back and looked at what payroll did over the last 20 years, and it essentially doubled. So if you go forward and use a typical amortization period of maybe 30 years, you could do the math and figure out that this new revenue stream for Portland would provide them the borrowing capacity of up to $3 billion. So you can easily see how the talk and chit-chat about bond rating and everything else. Bonding capacity is fabulous, but you need to have a revenue stream to do it. And they don't have one right now. They actually borrowed some $63 million, I believe, for their last orange line they opened. So their indebtedness up against their revenue stream is at a crisis situation. Same with Metro. Metro committed 20 years of federal gas tax flex funds for the orange line. They're also tapped out. Their partner Metro and TriMet are... have worked together to try to get us new revenues passed. Now, what does this do? This gives an unelected board, and I can tell you, these TriMet board members, there's not a single voice of dissent with anything they do there. Who does the TriMet board represent? Do they represent all the people, the employees out there that this new income tax would be imposed upon? Well, of course not. So who do they represent? The interests of congestion solvers? The Business Summit, the Oregon Business Summit, identified the most severe choke points in the Portland metropolitan region in their last meeting. And they have a series of six different locations, none of which were the number one and number two priorities for TriMet and Metro. The Powell Boulevard corridor, where they're planning to bus rapid transit, and the Southwest corridor, where they're planning either that or more than likely a light rail expansion. Neither one of those corridors were in their choke point priorities. And yet this new revenue stream, capable of borrowing billions of dollars, would allow them to not only revive the CRC, fund the BRT, and fund the Southwest Corridor Light Rail. That's what they're about. That's what they're attempting to do here. And that's what it would serve as. There's no restrictions on this. You're passing off the authority and giving them, as Mr. Ludlow said, the authority to impose an income tax with no representation. I was there when the last three appointees were appointed. It was stunning how biased the individuals were in favor of completely ignoring any voter participation in anything. I've been involved in the area initiative petitions, which strive to only have the voters participate. This is not a new adventure for the region. The region has been eyewitness to what's going on in the region, and they know what's coming and what to vote on and how to vote. That's why they've rejected it over and over again. And I can tell you, looking at the outcome between TriMet and Metro, you need to look at the newspapers and see where people throughout Portland and the entire region are screaming. They're screaming because there's no more affordability for housing, plummeting inventory. That's because the things that Metro and TriMet have been doing don't work. The last thing you need to be doing is giving them another revenue stream. You need to go back the opposite direction and find a bill next session and go apply some audits. And you may not know how bad it really is, but there's neighborhoods in Portland who are lined up with Portland City Council town halls complaining because the planning strategies of infill and insufficient capacity and everything else are not only making the neighborhoods unaffordable with traditional gentrification, but they're simultaneously ruining them with infill, heavily subsidized mixed-use structures that don't match the neighborhood, with inadequate parking, causing people to park all over the place. It's chaos. And yet, where is the documentation when somebody from Metro comes up here and tells the legislature what a fine job they're doing? Well, I can tell you where the documentation is. It's in the office of the Metro Auditor, an individually elected official who in the last 5 years has done three very interesting audits. One of them was to determine whether or not Metro tracked the results.
Excuse me, sir, but let's keep on transit.
Yeah. Well, this transit planning is I'm trying to get to a point here. I'll try to wrap up. The point is that the TriMet and Metro are not tracking and measuring the effectiveness of their planning strategies and concepts. And what they're ultimately doing are ruining neighborhoods one after another. And here they are. They're facing still to this year. Moss Adams, in their annual financial statement audit, concluded they still have a $1 billion unfunded benefits liability. They have no borrowing capacity, and they're desperate to have a new revenue stream. So please don't pass off your authority to ask them to come back to fund a CRC with another $450 million. Don't give away your authority, because if you pass this bill, they can do it on their own. And all they need to do is supplant current busing operations revenue and use it for debt service. Okay.
Thank you. Questions? Senator?
Yeah, I'd just like to make a point. I think this is a very good example of what kind of bill we shouldn't have in a short session. This was meant to be tweaks and rebalancing the budget, and we're not supposed to deal with policy bills this complex.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
That's all that we have signed up. We do not have paperwork on these, so we are not acting on this one or the previous bill, 1510, either today. So what?
Can you announce we're rolling them over until Wednesday?
And we are rolling them over until Wednesday. Okay, so I'm going to close on that one, and
I'll close on 1510 too.
And close 1510 as well. I think I'm going to want to. We're getting short. Let's go ahead and do these work sessions.
Yes, sir.
Don't do this, because I got to wait for 10 more minutes.
Yeah, if we wait 10 more minutes, we can do 1572, but we can do the others, Mr. Chair.
Which one can we do?
So 1591.
Okay, so we will open the work session on Senate Bill 1591, the insurance bill, and it's... Do we have Representative Shields here?
Senator Shields is in committee.
Senator Shields, sir. He's in committee?
Yeah. So, Sean could come up.
Sean, you want to talk about this while we're waiting for the senator?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of the Property Cash Insurers Association. And 1591-5 amendment. We have come to an agreement with Senator Shields, and this is dealing with the transparency portion of the bill that we talked about. There were several issues, if you remember, before in your committee, and we felt the transparency piece of this bill was something that the two sides can work on, and we did, and the dash 5 is reflective of that. I think in section 1, page 2, is the meat of it. Basically says that the director may provide information of the information from a complaint from any requester, and we wanted to make sure that the original language was put in chapter 731, which dealt with the confidentiality statute. So you provide this information to the complaint. The insurance division has procedures on what is redacted, and their current definition of persons includes individuals, business entities, and others that would be redacted so that you can't be identified in that complaint. Mm-hmm. And then in Section 3 of the bill, Mr. Chair, there's a 4-year sunset. So it becomes operative on January 1, 2017, with a sunset of in 4 years, 2021. And so, again, not to speak for Senator Shields, I think he can be here to talk about that. But those were the elements that we worked on with him, and happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions of Sean? Sort of waiting for Senator Shields. Is there anybody else who wanted to testify on it? I know there's a lot of industry work on this one.
see him yet.
Hmm?
He didn't see him yet. I think he was down in one of the subs.
Can you grab Thompson for me?
Sure.
I might just recess on it and move to the next one and get back to it when he comes. He wants to let him take it.
Mr. Chair, would you like me to give a quick rundown on where we're at in terms of this? Maybe if I do this, he'll be here by the time I get here.
Okay, go ahead.
So, Mr. Chair, we heard this bill on the 1st and the 3rd. We have it today on the 8th. Mr. Miller was just speaking to the Dash 5 amendments. The Dash 5 amendments, with the Dash 5, the measure has no fiscal impact, no revenue impact. This measure came to us with a subsequent referral on to the Committee on Joint Ways and Means because it was originally a task force bill. With the amendments, it does not need to go to Ways and Means anymore. We have gotten permission from the Senate President's office, should we decide to move the bill forward with the Dash 5s, to move it to the floor and rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means, Mr. Chair.
It didn't work.
Dang it.
He's not there.
I thought I was going to make it happen.
Is that another one? See if he's out there. If not, we'll recess on and come back when he gets here. You know what? We're going to recess on.
We need 5 more minutes for that one.
That one
we've
got to wait 6 minutes.
All right, so. We'll go back to the rest of the list then. So what do we got here? How about 1527?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1527.
All right, Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 1527 exempts prepaid transportation cards from the Uniform Disposition of Unclaimed Property Act and related statutes and from provisions related to the regulation of gift cards that which expire. There's no amendment to this bill. The bill has received a statement of no fiscal impact and a statement of no revenue impact. And that's where I'm at, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Monroe, did you want to say
something? Ready to move this one?
You may want to hear some testimony. I was wondering if you wanted to comment on your bill.
Heard about this?
This is a very important bill, and I think the TriMet folks may want to campaign, and when you're ready for a motion, I'll be happy to do that.
So, Mr. Dees, Edward, and Elizabeth, you all want to come up?
I have to go up to the room at 2:30 and meet some folks, but I'll be back. Time sinks don't move very fast.
Yes. Try again.
Chair Byers, members of the committee, clear your minds. This is technical. I'm Aaron Dees. I'm a manager of government affairs at TriMet, and I'd like to speak in support of Senate Bill 1527. As you know, TriMet is implementing a new electronic fare system that will go online in 2017. E-fare is a payment system that will better serve our riders by allowing them to pay with the transit debit card as they board a bus or train. Instead of fumbling with cash or needing to purchase a pass at a grocery store or a ticket vending machine, customers simply will tap a validator and board the vehicle. The system has many benefits. It includes balance protection if someone loses their card or the ability to reload value anytime, online, anywhere, and less waiting as they board. It also results in more convenience and better service. In the process of developing this new e-fare system, there were two problems that we identified that Senate Bill 1527 seeks to resolve. First, under current state law, after 3 years of inactivity, the unused balance in an e-fare account would be considered unearned revenue and would be subject to Oregon's unclaimed property law. This unclaimed property would be sent to the state's Department of State Lands, which means TriMet would lose this revenue and riders' cards would no longer be valid. On the second and separate problem is that under current law, TriMet's e-fare card would be considered a gift card, and thus unused or abandoned accounts would not be able to be archived. Given that we expect to have hundreds of thousands of these cards over time, the ability to archive old unused accounts would be helpful. Senate Bill 1527 resolves these two problems by exempting public transportation cards from the unclaimed property and gift card statutes. TriMet's e-fare system is similar to systems in Seattle, Salt Lake, and San Francisco, and our proposed solution is based on legislation enacted in those states. It's also important to note that transit agencies throughout the state, including Lane Transit District in Lane County, Salem-Kaiser Transit, and Cascades East Transit, which serve cities of Bend, Redmond, Prineville, Madras, and other cities of Central Oregon, are interested in versions of e-fare that would meet their particular needs. Knowing that making this transition would cause these transit agencies to lose critical fare revenue may discourage them from moving forward. Again, thanks for the opportunity to speak on this bill, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Okay. Let's let them all speak, and then okay. We'll ask questions. All right. Edward, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Edward McClone.
Pass the mic to you.
With Lane Transit District, I drew the second shortest straw, so I will speak next. Lane Transit District is also in the process of developing an e-fare system similar to TriMet's. As you're well aware, the University of Oregon is housed in the heart of our service area and represents nearly 25% of the ridership on our system. Young people these days expect the ability to make transactions on their cell phones, iPads, and whatever other electronic devices that they now have, and we find ourselves unable to do so with the paper fare system that we have today. In order to meet the growing and changing needs of our clientele and the demographics who ride our transit buses, electronic fare is a critical part of maintaining the relevance that transit plays in the transportation ecosystem in the Eugene-Springfield community. We face similar problems with the gift card statutes that Aaron has already explained, and we are happy that TriMet has already found the answer to it. We're several steps behind them in the process, but we expect to be trying to get an electronic fare system on board within the next 18 months. So we seek your support for this legislation to make that possible, and I'm happy to answer further questions. Thank you.
I'm going to ask if you three would step down for a second. I see Senator Shields is here, and I'm going to recess on 1527 and reopen on 1591. Senator Shields. We had Mr. Miller was up, and he testified to the details of the bill, that there was agreement. So we'll see if we can
there is. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chip Shields. I represent North and Northeast Portland in the Oregon State Senate District 22. We have reached agreement with the industry, and you see that reflected in the Dash 5 amendments. There's still a small chance that we might need to work something out in the House. I talked to Sean Miller, and we're committed to moving this bill forward at this time.
Thank you, Senator. Question to the Senator? Seeing none, go ahead.
Yeah, I want to vote for this, but I don't want any wholesale changes in the House. I'm just tell you that I'm not going to be for that.
I don't think that'll happen.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, I wish that would happen, but I don't think it's going to happen.
Oh, okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we are in work session. The chair moves the Dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 1591. Discussion on the motion.
I think it's good when there's compromise in this building. And this was a perfect example of that.
Transparency is good.
Well, I didn't say transparent. It's anything but transparent.
Any opposition to the bill? Seeing none. Senate Bill 1591. Excuse me, that was the amendment. I'm getting ahead of myself. The amendment, so the Dash 5s pass. Senate Bill
1591.
The chair moves Senate Bill 1591, as amended by the Dash 5s, to the Senate floor, but they do pass, and rescind the referral to Ways and Means.
Are you sure?
You want to repeat that?
I've got the script down.
Okay.
Discussion on that motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? Okay. Senate Bill 1591. Huh? Shields carries. Senate Bill 1591, as amended by the Dash 5, is moved to the Senate floor. With a do-pass recommendation, Senator Shields will carry. We'll close on 1591, and we'll reopen on 1527. Thank you for your indulgence.
Chair Byron, members of the committee, Elizabeth Remley here today on behalf of the Technology Association of Oregon, a leading Oregon-based technology association representing more than 400 developers and technology-related businesses in the Oregon and Southwest Washington area. One of our members actually helped TriMet develop one of their first electronic systems for selling tickets. Global Sherpa is based in Portland. They developed the current mobile app that you can use to buy TriMet's tickets. We expect that Global Sherpa and others of our members will be involved as we move into the e-fare realm. And so we're here today to support Senate Bill 1527. We appreciate the work that TriMet's done, and I'd be glad to answer any questions. You guys have a letter explaining our support, so I'll keep it short. Thanks.
Thank you. Questions of the panel. Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are two parts to this bill. There's the archival part, which I have no problem at all with, and then there's the part where you want to get out of the law that already exists for cards, and I have a little problem with that. We went to great pains a few years ago to make sure that there was a place where people could go to find their unclaimed credit card and gift card balances, and that's the Division of State Lands. And we created the escheat for gift cards. And this works very much like other gift cards. I have a Starbucks card, and I can do the same thing. I can go to Starbucks, and I can use it just like you're talking about using it on your transit. And I can increase it by, you know, putting more money in it and keep using it. But if I don't use it for 3 years, it will be escheated to the state lands. And I think that doing this for a public agency when we wouldn't do it for a private agency is a problem for me. I like to see all unused funds. So you're talking about the fact that this would keep you from having revenue, but this is unearned revenue. Like it or not, it's unearned revenue. You haven't given the rides to people that this money represents. I don't see why it's any different. So this part of the bill, I can't quite get there. Can you explain to me why this is different from my Starbucks card?
Chair Byer, Senator Riley, I am not sure about the Starbucks card. It would have been my impression that a Starbucks card would have fallen under the gift card statute because it retains value on it. And if it does, in that case, it would never expire. So it would never escheat to the state. I think the argument that we're making with this bill is that our current fare system, people pay, our riders pay us money for rides. Either it's a weekly pass, monthly pass, annual pass, or tickets. In that process, we agree to give them those rides. This new system makes it so that we can, instead of them losing the value, if they lose the tickets or they just don't use them and then their dog eats them or whatnot, we'll always be able to give them that ride because they will have an account that can't be lost. So for providing the consumer better service, this will actually give them much better service. It's important for TriMet to retain as much of our fare revenue as possible because it's a stream of revenue that's important to us and it's important to our business community that pays about 55 to 60% of our operating services. The other component, too, is that TriMet actually will have a system that is as robust as the states, actually even more robust than the states, in getting folks back their money. So we'll be contacting them twice with the letters. If they give us contact information, we will give them multiple opportunities to either say, hey, my card's still going, please leave it alone, or here's your money back. So in both of those situations, and for us, the concern is we get the money, we spend it on service, we give them the credit that never goes away, and it would never expire. They would always have it available.
Hello, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
So where in the bill does it say that you're going to develop that that system to give them back, you know, send them two letters? Where is that stated?
Yeah, Chair Beyer, Senator Riley, we're developing that right now. I can actually bring up Mr. Tucker, who is developing, who is our head of the development of this program, to talk about where we are in the process. We've looked at many other states and looked at their processes and looked at, you know, what's the best way to keep the cards active if they're active and get folks back their money. If and right now that's what we're leaning towards. If you'd like, you okay? Okay.
No, thank you.
Thank you.
More? Senator Monroe?
Yeah, I introduced this bill for a number of reasons. My brother visits Chicago a lot, and he bought one of these e-cards for riding the transit system in Chicago and didn't use it all up. So when he came back to Portland, he wrote the transit agency a note and asked for his money back, and they told him because he wasn't a citizen of Illinois, he couldn't have it. That seemed like objectionable to me. I really like this new system. I'm an old man, and I'm just learning this technology stuff. I can barely manage a computer, but I know that the world is going high tech. Mm-hmm. And TriMet, to serve the public better, and the other transit agencies, Lane and others, want to go high tech. So what happens? They put down a $10 bill or a $20 bill, and they use up a portion of that. It's checked off every time they ride the bus or the train, but maybe they don't use it all up. And, you know, maybe they stop using transit. After 3 years, TriMet or Lane are going to contact them in writing and say, okay, you got this much money left on your ticket now. Do you want it back? If so, they'll send it back to them. And so it seems to me that this is a more fair way to manage this e-fare system, high-tech stuff, and make sure that the rider gets all of the service that they paid for, and if they don't use it all, gets their money back. Seems very simple and reasonable to me.
Senator Girard.
Well, since we're making statements, I'd just like to remind the people at the dais here, this is all predicated on a bill that passed on party lines that basically was a money grab by the states for private gift card holders, of which then TriMet came under the certain clauses. So this is a carve-out, as was brought out by Senator Riley, for the public sector, but it doesn't, you know, it doesn't do the same for the private sector, and it doesn't overturn the bill that created the problem. So some of us said this would be a problem. The problem I have is this is a carve-out. If you're going to do it for TriMet, you should do it for everybody. I agree with TriMet that this should be done. I don't have a problem with that, but I do have a problem with if you're going to overturn it. It should be everybody that bill hit between the eyeballs with gift cards.
Then introduce another bill.
Okay. Well, I'll get the same result as anything else I do.
Let's deal with one at a time. Is there any other questions of this panel? Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Is there anybody else who wishes to comment on this? All right, we will. Can I take this in the workshop? We'll close the public hearing and open the work session. Senator Monroe.
Aye.
No, you
got to move
the
bill. You wanted to move the
bill. Oh, I thought you moved it.
No.
Okay. I moved the bill with a due pass recommendation to the Senate.
Senator Monroe has moved
Senate Bill 1527
to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Yes.
Discussion, Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to vote yes on this bill. There are pieces of it that I like and pieces of it that I don't really like, but TriMet has been a good thing, and all the transit districts have been really good things for my district and for a lot of districts. And so I'm going to vote yes on the bill with reservations.
Okay. Further discussion? Okay. All those who, I should do it the other way. Is there any objections? It's easier. Senator Girard objects? Anybody else want to object?
Well, maybe I can now.
I don't care. You.
No, I'm just kidding.
What is the bill number again? It's this one, right? Let's see. Senate Bill 1527 passes to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation with Senator Girard in opposition. So we'll close on that.
Can I carry?
No, you can't. Senator Monroe will carry.
But in case you leave, like you did last time, I'll tell you.
Okay, so are we ready? Can we take up these other ones, or do we have to wait?
Well, no, I have to wait because, I need him to do that.
Why don't we do 1543 then, Mr. Chair?
Okay, we will open the public hearing on 1543. Patrick.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1543 changes the entity receiving revenues from the sale of wine country registration plates from the Tourism Commission, the Wine Board. I will dispense for that because we actually have a dash one amendment which replaces the original measure. The dash one directs the Tourism Commission to distribute one half of revenues from the sale of wine country vehicle registration plates for the purpose of wine and culinary tourism promotion in collaboration with the Wine Board and relevant regional wine industry associations. It permits the Department of Transportation to issue wine country plates to vehicles operated by the board. As an emergency clause would take effect upon passage with the dash one amendment, there is a minimal fiscal and a minimal revenue. This measure has a referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, but given the fiscal and revenue statements, the Senate President's office has given us tentative approval upon the chair's discretion to move the bill directly to the floor, Mr. Chair.
Do we have a list?
Oh, yes. Why don't we have Mr. Charman come up while I get that
Dan,
list.
Dan, you want to start? You brought reinforcements.
I did. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dan Jarman today representing the Oregon Wine Growers Association. I wanted to thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for hearing this bill important to the wine industry. Also want to just thank Senator Jackie Winters, who, for obvious reasons, can't be with us today. She is our bill sponsor. We're very grateful for her doing that for the Oregon Wine Growers Association. She was actually the author, along with then-Representative Kevin Cameron, of the 2011 legislation that established the Oregon Wine Country license plate. She fully understands and supports what we're trying to accomplish with this legislation, and she's always been a champion of the Oregon wine industry, and we are very grateful to her. We will be brief today, given the time of the committee. We've met with all of you, so you know very well about this bill and how it's changed from its original form to now what's in the dash one amendment, which we will talk about today. I'm going to turn it over to three leaders of the wine industry who are with us today. First, David Beck, the owner of Crawford Beck Vineyards and the current president of the Oregon Wine Growers Association. Next, Michael Donovan, who is the managing director of Irvine Family Vineyards in Ashland and a former president of the Wine Growers Association, also very involved in the development of the 2011 legislation. And then finally, John Patacoli, owner of Red Hawk Vineyards and Winery outside of Salem. He's here today representing the Willamette Valley Wineries Association. So let me turn it over to Dr. Beck. Thank you very much.
Chairman Beyer and members of the committee, thank you very much for letting us come and talk to you briefly about this bill, SB 1543-1. The Oregon Wine Growers Association is a statewide membership organization representing the interests of Oregon's wineries and vineyards. And since the Wine Country license plate was created in 2011, the number of Oregon wineries has increased from 463 to over 700. The industry's economic impact for the state is over $3.3 billion annually, with over 22,000 jobs scattered around the state. And most notably for this conversation, the wine-related tourism contributes more than $208 million to the Oregon economy each year. As our industry has grown, so have direct-to-consumer sales from tasting rooms. Therefore, the increasing wine tourism and bringing more customers into wine country is critical to the wine industry's future success and growth. The OWA worked on the Wine Country License Plate Bill in 2011. But as spending plans were developed last year for the first allocations, we heard from a number of local winery associations and industry members that some important changes were in order for this bill, for this process. I'll call on my colleagues and fellow members of the OWA, Mr. Donovan, Mr. Patacoli, to address some of the specifics of what we propose. But I only want to say here that dollars for tourism are precious. So we are very eager to help coordinate their allocation and spend them wisely. And finally, I must say that the Oregon Wine Growers Association deeply values its relationship with Travel Oregon, and our members and regional wine associations want to be real partners with the various tourism groups around the state to help attract tourists and customers to wine country. Thank you, gentlemen. And let me ask Mr. Donovan if he would continue.
Sure. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. As Mr. Jarman indicated, was a past president of the Oregon Wine Board and the Oregon Wine Growers Association. I am also the current president of the Southern Oregon Winery Association, which, can you hear?
Excuse me, I don't think you put your name on the record.
Oh, I apologize. Michael Donovan. I am now the current president of the Southern Oregon Winery Association, which represents wineries from Elkton all the way to Ashland. And as Dr. Beck has indicated, our industry has seen a lot of very important growth in over the last 10 years. And we're actually I was present in 2011, working in a very strong way with Angie Morris from Travel Salem, and as she brought this idea forward, and of course working with Todd Davidson from Travel Oregon, and of course a lot of other industry folks like David Adelsheim to create this Oregon wine license plate legislation. That legislation is, as I'm sure most of you know, established a $30 a plate surcharge, with those monies going to be administered through Travel Oregon. And they would really oversee that process through two programs. The first, of course, was a grant program for competitive matching grants that were dedicated exclusively for wine and culinary tourism. The second half was really a program, monies that were allocated out to local destination marketing organizations that really ended up being allocated for general tourism. But the funds were allocated on the basis of vineyard acreage. So we always thought there was a little disconnect there, that the funds that were actually dedicated for vineyard acreage ended up being for general tourism. We're very supportive of the competitive grant program, and we're not seeking any change in that portion of the legislation. And Dash 1 amendments indicate we actually believe that Travel Oregon and the destination marketing organizations we can work with very effectively with just a few minor changes. The first would be to clarify that the program monies on promoting destination tourism would be allocated for wine and culinary tourism, much like the grant, exactly like the grant proposals would be. That was, we know, the intent of the original legislation, and we want to clarify that in statute. We also have heard that there was collaboration, I think, with members of the industry. I think, though, that the winery associations throughout the state actually were not formally brought into any of this process, either through the Oregon Wine Board or through an association as large as the Willamette Valley Winery Association, the Southern Oregon Winery Association, et cetera, for devising and strategizing about how best to spend these program monies. We would suggest that the winery associations appoint a liaison to work directly with the DMOs, but all that would be worked out with through this bill and spelled out by Travel Oregon through rulemaking. Other than those two changes, the Oregon Wine Growers Association seeks no other changes to this program. We believe that this modified program would ensure that our limited tax dollars are best utilized to avoid any duplicative efforts and effectively promote destination tourism with wine and culinary initiatives. Thank you.
I guess if I can ask a question.
Yes,
Mr. Chair. One of the issues that obviously I know it's got to pop up is, what is the definition of wine and culinary tourism? And
exactly.
A lot of things, you know, I've heard members of your industry before say that basically the smaller wineries that 60% to 70% of your sales are on site, and you need to have those events. And so if you're having a, you know, a Bike Across Oregon event, and it happens to go through winery country, does that qualify as a wine and culinary event? Or if you,
Chairman Beyer, members of the committee, I believe that we are in the process of really being able to determine what exactly wine and culinary, effective wine and culinary tourism strategies should be. And in so coming up with that definition, we would really would like to be at the table, because obviously the Oregon Wine Board is the agency here in the state that's charged with effectively promoting the wine industry in Oregon, and we believe that we have strategies in place that we don't want to see duplicative efforts going on in various parts of the state. We'd rather have a coherent strategy. These are very limited dollars. We're talking about probably between in the neighborhood of $150,000 to $200,000, which is significant for our industry. And we believe that if they're spent effectively, we can continue to grow the Oregon wine industry.
Yeah, but when you get it down to the individual destination marketing there, the numbers get smaller. And
yes,
I think in terms of co-op things, I would hate, one of the things I'm fearful of is I would hate to get too tight into a definition where you may not be able to effectively use the money. There, I guess I lean towards, and Dan and I have talked about this, I lean towards the sort of mandatory or prescribed collaboration, but then letting you guys, frankly, figure it out at the local level.
Mr. Chair, let me underscore a little bit of what Michael had to say. I think that the example you used is a very good one about promoting a bike tour through the state. I think that in the course of that, destination marketing organization, when it does something like that, if it merely mentions the wineries along the way and the wine and restaurants close to the route and accommodations that folks can utilize that have those aspects, I think that certainly meets the intent and the definition of this. And at the end of the day, we give a lot of discretion to Travel Oregon. Travel Oregon is the one that receives these plans that they're developed at the local levels, and it certainly is going to take a look at this and see the kind of initiatives that are proposed. But again, more than anything, it's the message that the focus really needs to stay on the wine side, since the money is coming from the wine country license plate. But I think your point is a very good one.
Okay. Sorry to interrupt.
No.
Sir.
Thank you, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. My name is John Patacoli. I own a Red Hawk Winery right here in West Salem, and I'm here representing the Willamette Valley Wineries Association, one of the 11 signers of this letter, which I believe you have or will have, promoting or supporting these amendments. And the reason we are supporting, and it was a unanimous vote at the board level, is, as Michael said, this is a relatively small amount of money when you think about our neighbors to the south in particular and our neighbors to the north. And so while it's great and it's new and we've got an opportunity to spend it, there hasn't been, we don't think, enough coordination with how we're spending it. One person's doing one thing in one part of the state that's already being done. If we were all talking, if there was a little more formal process, we think we could accomplish a lot more and use the money the most effective way. Like the Willamette Valley Winery Association, we have a program going, a marketing program called Think Oregon, Drink Pinot, and we're trying to market this. Now, does everybody know we're doing that? Maybe not. So is somebody going to take some of this money and develop a very similar program around Pinot Noir when one already exists? We hope not. So that's why we support these amendments. Thank you.
Questions? Senator?
Yeah, I think you should come up with a new slogan if you want to think of the legislature, drink copious amounts of Pinot.
So, Mr. Chair, that's the end of our formal testimony. Just two quick points. First, there's one other provision that was in the original bill that we've continued with the dash ones, which I think we've talked to you about. We realize that the wine board has a state motor pool vehicle assigned to it, and the wine board leaders, as they travel the state promoting the industry, show up with a state car. car and not one that says Oregon Wine Country, where they can further their promotion. We talked to ODOT and DMV about this. They said that we needed a statutory clarification to allow for the wine board to have a Wine Country license plate on its state motor pool vehicle. The bill also does that, obviously a very minor change. And then the last thing I would say, the question is comes up during a short session is why in a short session? And the reason it's necessary this short session is the way the funding streams allow, the next round of funding will go out in essence July of 2017, which means in the winter and spring of 2017, when you're in the middle of a legislative session, all those plans are starting to happen. And we want to be involved in that planning phase, which obviously is something that would need to happen in this session. So thank you. I wanted to get ahead of that question.
Thank you very much.
And we appreciate your support.
Again, any questions? Thank you all.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for making the trip up. Mr. Cross.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross, and for the record, I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Destination Marketing Organizations. We are opposed to the proposed legislation, and it pains us because we are good partners, and we do want to work closer with the wine industry, and in many communities, we indeed do. And frankly, maybe had we known of some of their concerns, we could have collaborated a little bit earlier on the legislation instead of being startled by its introduction when we really hadn't had a chance to figure out what their concerns were. And I think in identifying some of their concerns in terms of, I think we share the same goal. How do we use these dollars to the best and highest use? Their proposed amendments, the proposal to try and provide through rules, collaborative process, we're very supportive, and that makes sense. Our problem is with the policy change to specifically require the regional dollars to be use for wine and culinary tourism only. And when this legislation passed, the intent, and it's on public record, was to use half of these funds, the grant process, specific to wine and culinary tourism events. But the other half, the regional dollars, were to be allowed for tourism, allowed to help sustain local tourism organizations and their role in their communities and their economies. As it happens, all of the regional programs, the four contracts that they have with Travel Oregon, which were, I think, consummated last fall, all do have, they're all focused on wine and culinary events. Those are important assets, and Travel Oregon asked the organizations to try and develop strategies that would enhance that those kind of tourism events, and the organizations did. But what's to say a couple years from now that indeed maybe that bike event or maybe a windsurfing event might be a wonderful attraction and a way to get more tourists into an area where we can then also promote wineries and other local assets. So we're very nervous about this recommendation, especially since we really haven't seen how this program is unfolding. I mean, we've seen 6 months of this program, and don't really know if we're getting our best return. There may be other policy changes that should be considered. And it may be that when the Wine Board and Travel Oregon and the destination marketing entities work through this, there may be other policy changes. We're just not comfortable supporting change, a major change to the program at this time. Can I answer
any questions?
Questions
for Bill? I see none. Thank you, Bill. Is there anybody else who feels the need to talk? We're starting to run out of time. I see none. I'm going to, we're going to roll this one over to our next meeting. The President of the Senate has requested that we do that. So we'll close the work session on that. And I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1572, the Community Solar Bill. And we heard this one. We heard this a couple of times. So the chair will move the dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 1572.
What's a dash 3?
Discussion.
Mr. Chair, can I just have a moment?
Just a second here.
I just wanted to make sure.
Make sure they're up. Are they not up?
I don't know.
We looked this morning and they weren't there.
They're not up.
Dash 5.
We're in recess, please.
We're in recess.
We looked this morning and they weren't there.
They were there the other day. That's weird. Well, we're having a little trouble with the electronic bill tracking system. Things that were there before are not there today.
Why is that? We're going to have to roll this over too, Mr. Chair.
All right. We will close the work session and roll over 1572. How about, can we do 1583?
No, Mr.
We can't. Well, it looks like we need to roll them over.
Yes, however, there is one person for 1546 who came from Hood River today.
Oh,
we're hoping
there are actually two
people.
There are actually two.
Come on, we will open the public hearing on 1546.
Mr. Chair, I'll just briefly, while they're coming up, say that this is the bill that prohibits tourists from touring a motor vehicle from a parking facility without first being contacted by the owner of the facility. I'll do a bigger introduction later if the senator wants to say something.
No, I just wanted to say I'm glad that we're going to just do this. I won't do any testimony right now because we're short on time.
Short on time.
We've got a couple of people from a long distance away who want to testify.
And we have time on our next agenda. Thank
Chair,
you, gentlemen.
Chair Breyer, committee, thank you very much. My name is Michael Coe. I'm with Parking Enforcement Services, also known as Retriever Towing. I live in Hood River, but our business operations are throughout the Willamette Valley from Vancouver down to Salem. We specifically work on private property parking issues for our customers. We believe that any changes to Chapter 98 should be with the goal to ensure citizen protection from reasonable rates, eliminate unscrupulous towing practices, and improving towing regulations. We are very supportive of those and have been in almost every community that we work with. Retrievers always stood for ethical business practices. We were the first company to use photos to prove infractions prior to removing the vehicle, a standard required by many municipalities today. We're the first to set standards for signage and notification of parking rules. We stand by every tow, and if the tow is found faulty in any way, we return the money. We have signed agreements stating what we are to patrol for and not to patrol for. Section 1A and B limits towing companies from being able to use contract patrol properties for vehicles that are in violation of posted parking rules and renter contracted parking rules. In residential communities, a lot of people sign an agreement that they have to display their permit, that they agree to abide by their parking rules and where to park. And with commercial properties, most of the properties have to have posted parking rules for instructing people what to do and where to park and where they can't park. there's limited time to prepare today. I just found out a couple of days ago about this, so I did prepare some documentation. One document that I gave her there is about towing education. Talks about the different types of towing in the state of Oregon, and also talks about impound rates and practices. In addition, there's another document that talks about predatory towing versus patrol towing. Parking facilities have many of the same needs as public property, and therefore need the same rights to enforce parking rules, the same parking rules that municipalities have.
I'm going to apologize, but I'm going to have to ask you to kind of hurry up a bit.
Okay.
I've got to be out of here. I'm supposed
to
get out of here 5 minutes ago.
a lot of this I prepared for you in type for your review. There's several things that I think this bill is missing. Lien law updates, some changes to 98.856, which addresses drop fees requirement for municipalities that choose to regulate towing. Basically instructing them to adhere to some kind of rate increase for tied to CPI increases. Almost every municipality that has adopted any kind of dictates as far as price control regarding towing have not updated their rates, and therefore there's some municipalities we haven't had an increase in 6 years. So And certainly adequate protections and standards for patrol towing to eliminate fly-by-night towers that are out there. I have been working with Jason and the State Association on some ideas that that would prevent this and streamline and create a better sense of enforcement out there that would ensure citizen protection, but also protect the towers. What's going on is there's a few bad apples, and in the areas that they've adopted any kind of regulatory process, it's because there's some fly-by-nighters out there.
I want to let your colleague have a chance to talk.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, and we will look at the material you provided.
Thank you, Chairman and Committee. In the interest of time, my meter's ticking too, so I appreciate your time here. I'm with the Oregon Tow Truck Association, and I represent the whole state. I'm from Hood River as well. So basically, our main issue.
Could you put your name on the record, sir?
Pardon me?
Could you put your name on the record?
Okay, I'm Jason Shaner.
Thank you.
With the Oregon Tow Truck Association, president this year. One of the big issues we have with this is just removes the notice exemptions for towing motor vehicles violating certain no parking signs. Almost every towing company in the state does do some type of private property removals. The vast majority don't do a patrol towing just because it's more of an urban issue. There's more demand for that type of thing. But parking problems are universal all over. People love to park wherever there's a spot the car will fit. They love to park in front of garbage cans, dumpsters, things that people need to service at all hours of the day and night. We feel that the signage needs to be kind of an increased thing rather than a decreased one. I don't know why we would necessarily want to remove signage from areas that people tend to park in front of. We definitely agree with the photographs of parking removals. That way people can see their vehicle in relation to the sign, which is usually close to the front of the car that they've parked. It just helps us not be the evil towers, just that we are just doing our job and helping keep the system flowing. So I'm just here to answer any questions you may have.
Great. Does anybody have any questions?
I got one quick one.
Go ahead.
Do you ever get contracts from like a landlord that has a parking facility and say he's got three spaces that he doesn't want anybody parking at? This is just an example. So if you find somebody in those three spaces, you could tow. Is that pretty common?
I think I can address that. Yes, especially where the parking is more condensed, like Northwest Portland. You have a boutique or a small doctor's office or dentist office or something like that. It has limited spaces, and you have the bar across the street that is serving patrons, and people feel they need to park there. Well, people make choices, and they choose not to frequent or to purchase or go to an establishment because there's never any parking. So they have to keep those spaces clear. Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions?
Well, I think Fred and I were talking about this earlier. So there was something in the bill about you would have to notify the owner before.
Or agent.
Or agent before the car's towed.
Mm-hmm.
So does that mean the owner of the car or the owner of the parking lot?
Parking lot.
Okay.
But it would be on an individual basis.
Yeah.
One of the harder things in our industry is that there's that ownership or agent can be a little bit hard to ascertain as well, because many spots have spaces that are rented to an individual person, right. Like space number 9 on Cascade Avenue is rented to this person.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
We don't even know who that is. We have no way as a tower to know who is the rightful owner.
Yeah.
Every municipality that like Washington doesn't allow for patrol towing. And what has happened in every single case is that the business or the residential property then has to hire security, which causes rates to go up for the renter because they have an added cost to provide the security. If they don't, then people are parking everywhere. It's a nightmare. And then people move out and they have more turnover in their complexes or at their establishments. So Tualatin has an issue, Fairview has an issue, and State of Washington has an issue.
Okay. Anything else?
Well, we need to dive in this more. Yeah. We're out of time.
We'll have that chance. We'll bring it over. So thank you very much for coming in. We will look at the material.
We're available anytime.
Right?
Yes.
We'll put it up on our system.
We'll carry everything.
And we're carrying every other bill that was on the agenda today that we did not work, we are carrying over till our next meeting. And with that, we will adjourn the public hearing and we will adjourn the meeting.
We may not. I mean, we have the option of not.